Under glass and quiet light. Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app.
Today is going to be a fun one. We are really getting into the machinery of life itself.
Absolutely. And to kick things off, I want to start with a concept that I think we all kind of wrestle with when we think about biology. I like to call it the volume knob of identity.
Volume knob. Okay, I like that.
Because here's the problem, right? Every single cell in your body, it has the exact same instruction manual.
Same DNA, yeah.
The same DNA.
Yeah.
But a skin cell is doing something completely different than, say, a neuron in your brain. How does the neuron know to be a neuron and not a patch of skin?
Right. It really all comes down to silencing. The cell has to shut down the genes. It just doesn't need. It's, you know, not just about what you play. It's about what you mute.
And we know there's a machine responsible for this. A literal cellular engine that goes around turning genes off. But here's the mystery that has been bugging scientists for years. We understand the engine, but we haven't really understood the GPS.
Yeah, that's the core question. How does this machine decide where to land? How does it tell the difference between a gene that needs to be active and one that needs to be, well, silenced forever?
And here is the twist in the story we're covering today. For a long time, there was this one component of the machine, a protein called EPOP. And everyone thought it was a brake.
Mm-hmm. They thought it slowed the machine down.
That the data seemed to suggest it was a hindrance, a negative regulator.
But, and this is why we love doing these deep dives, what if we were looking at it all wrong? What if the thing we thought was a brake is actually a turbo button?
A turbo button, I like that.
But not just any turbo button, one that only works on specific types of, let's call them road surfaces, hidden inside our DNA.
That changes everything. It suggests the machine is actually reading the texture of the DNA itself to make decisions.
Exactly. So today we are digging into a paper that really flips the script on EPOP and reveals a whole new layer of the genetic code.
Let's do it. But before we unpack all the science, we have to give credit where it's due.
Of course.
Today we're celebrating the work of Jeffrey Granat, Sengxin Liu, Danny Reinberg, and all of their colleagues.
It's a powerhouse team. This research comes out of NYU Langone Health and the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, HHMI.
And this is hot off the press. This paper was just published in PNAS, that's the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, on February 6, 2026.
So this is very cutting edge stuff.
Okay, let's set the stage. We need to talk about the machine itself, the Polycomb Repressive Complex 2.
PRC2.
Right, PRC2. I think most of our listeners will know the name, but could you remind us exactly what its day job is in the cell?
So PRC2 is basically the heavyweight champion of gene silencing. Its main job is to deposit a chemical tag called H3K27E3.
Which is a mouthful.
It is a mouthful. It stands for trimethylation of lysine 27 on histone H3. But you can just think of it as a permanent do not enter sign. Okay. When PRC2 puts this tag on a region of DNA, it compacts the chromatin. It basically scrunches it up so tight that the genes there can't be read.
So PRC2 is the worker putting up all those do not enter signs. And we know this is absolutely crucial because if you don't have PRC2, an embryo just can't develop.
No, you just get a mess of confused cells. It's essential.
But here's the challenge we mentioned in the intro. PRC2 needs to find these nucleation sites.
The landing strips.
Exactly, landing strips in the genome where the silencing has to start. And then once it lands, the silencing just spreads out from there.
And those landing strips are usually in these specific regions called CPG islands. But PRC2, it can't find them on its own.
It can't.
No, it's surprisingly bad at navigation. It's like a pilot flying totally blind. It needs co-pilots. We call them cofactors or accessory proteins.
Okay, so it has helpers?
It has helpers. And we've known about a few of them for a while, like MTF2 and JARED2. These proteins grab onto PRC2 and they physically guide it to the DNA.
And then there's EPOP, the controversial one.
EPUP. Yeah, EPUP has been a real puzzle for a long time. It's found hanging out with PRC2. It's found at these nucleation sites in really high amounts. But previous studies showed this really strange result.
What was that?
If you get rid of EPA2, the amount of PRC2 on the DNA actually goes up.
Which is so counterintuitive. It led everyone to think, oh, EPUP must be keeping PRC2 away. It's a bouncer. It's stopping the machine from binding.
That was the prevailing theory, a negative regulator. But logically, it just didn't make sense. Why would the cell put a stop sign in the exact same place where it needs to do the most work?
Right. Why recruit a protein just to hinder yourself?
That contradiction is exactly what this team wanted to solve. And to do it, they had to get really, really creative with their methods. They realized that just observing wasn't cutting it. So they used a two-pronged attack, the test tube and the cell.
Let's start with the test tube, the in vitro biochemistry.
This is where they rebuild the engine from scratch.
So they took the core PRC2 machine, the human proteins, and they just mixed it with the different cofactors.
Right, they made a PRC2 MTF2 version and a PRC2 EPOPE version, but the real innovation was the road they built for these machines to drive on.
Okay.
They didn't just throw in naked DNA, they built what are called dinucleosomes.
I want to pause on that because it sounds really important. Why dinucleosomes? Why not just a simple strand of DNA?
Well, because in your body, DNA isn't just a loose string, right? It's wrapped around these protein spools called nucleosomes.
Yeah.
If you want to test how the machine works in real life, you have to test it on the spools.
It has to be the real context.
A dinucleosome is just two of these spools connected by a little bridge of DNA.
And that bridge is the crucial part here, isn't it?
It is the key. That bridge is called the linker DNA. And the researchers, they manipulated the sequence of that bridge. They created bridges with random letters, bridges with GCN repeats, and bridges with GA repeats. They wanted to see how the machine handles different road textures.
That's strategy one, building the track. Now, what about strategy two? That involves the cells, and this is where they figured out why the old studies might have been wrong.
Yeah, the old studies looked at cells in what's called steady state.
Meaning the house was already built, the do not enter signs were already up.
Exactly. So if you fire the plumber, maybe the electrician tries to step in, and it gets really messy to interpret.
Do you see weird compensation effects?
You do. So this team used something called a rescue system. They took mouse embryonic stem cells, and they knocked out a core piece of the PRC2 machine called ED.
So they broke the machine entirely.
Yeah.
No silencing, no tags, a totally blank slate.
A blank slate. Then they added the missing piece back in, and they watched exactly what happened in the first 24 hours.
So they were watching the construction crew arrive at the empty lot for the very first time.
Yes, and that allowed them to distinguish between arriving at the site versus actually doing the work.
And that distinction is what blew this whole case wide open.
Yeah.
So let's get to the good stuff. What did they find?
Okay, finding number one came from the test tube results. When they tested EPOP in isolation with the PRC2 core, it didn't slow anything down.
It didn't.
Not at all. It robustly stimulated activity.
So in a vacuum, EPOP makes the machine work faster. It's an activator, not an inhibitor.
Correct. But the real magic happened in the cells. When they used that rescue system to watch the first 24 hours, they found something fascinating about recruitment.
Recruitment meaning just getting to the DNA in the first place.
Right. When they removed EPOP from the cells, the PRC2 machine, it still arrived. It got to the nucleation sites just fine.
Wow. Which is totally different from MTF2, right? If you lose MTF2, the machine gets lost.
Exactly. MTF2 is the bus driver. Without it, you don't even get to the site. But EPOP is more like the master mechanic.
Okay.
Because without EPOP, the machine arrives. But the actual output, the amount of those H3K27E3 tags, it dropped by about 50%.
Whoa. So the crew shows up, but they only do half the work.
That is the crucial distinction. EPOP isn't there to help them land. It's there to make sure that once they land, they are incredibly efficient at laying down those silence tags.
That completely flips the negative regulator theory on its head. But this is where it gets really specific, right? This connects back to those dinucleosomes and the road texture.
This is the real aha moment, the DNA sequence specificity.
They found that the cofactors MTF2 and EPOP, they have preferences. They like different kinds of roads.
Exactly. MTF2 is most active when the linker DNA, that bridge between the spools, is full of GCN repeats. That's a specific pattern of genetic letters.
But EPOP.
EPOP didn't care about GCN. It went absolutely crazy for GA repeats.
And that is huge. It means the genome has different zip codes. Some areas are GCN rich, some are GA rich. And the cell is using different tools to activate its silencing machinery depending on which zip code it's in.
It's a level of granularity we just didn't appreciate before.
Yeah.
We used to think PRC2 just landed on CPG islands as a general rule. Now we know it's reading the nuanced text between the nucleosomes.
But wait, I have to ask about the mechanics of this. We know MTF2 has a part of it that can actually bind to DNA. It'd have a hand to grab that GCN sequence. But what about EPOP? You mentioned it was sort of unstructured.
And that's the paradox. EPOP is what we call an intrinsically disordered protein. It doesn't have a known DNA binding domain. Structurally, it shouldn't be able to read the DNA.
So how does it know it's on a GA repeat?
The data suggests it's recognizing the context. It's not just grabbing the DNA string, it's interacting with the whole package, the DNA plus the nucleosome spools. It effectively recognizes what you could call GA-rich chromatin.
That's wild. It's sensing the landscape, not just reading a signpost.
Precisely. And this explains why the biochemical experiments showed that EPLP enhanced binding to these specific GA nucleosomes. Even though it can't bind naked DNA very well on its own, it needs the structure of the spool to do its job.
Okay, so let's zoom out. We've resolved the controversy, but I want to circle back to why everyone thought EPOP was the bad guy before. You mentioned that compensation effect. Can you walk us through that?
Right, it goes back to that steady state versus clean slate issue. In the old experiments, when they removed EPOP, the cell, it sort of panicked a little bit.
The system sensed a deficit.
Yes. And the other cofactor we mentioned, GERD2, rushed in to fill the gap. Now, GERD2 is actually a better recruiter than EPOP is. It's better at bringing the machine to the DNA.
So because GERD2 rushed in, from the outside, it looked like there was more machine at the site.
Exactly. It looked like recruitment went up, so the conclusion was, well, EPOP must have been keeping things down. But by using the rescue system, by wiping the slate clean, Granette and his team showed that EPOP's true job isn't holding the door. It's catalysis. It's making the machine run hot.
So what does this mean for the bigger picture? We're talking about development, about how a ball of cells becomes a person. Why does the cell need two different ways to turn on the same engine? Why have a GCN activator and a GA activator?
Well, it suggests a model of what we can call spatial regulation. The genome isn't just one long string. It has these domains defined by their sequence, the GCN areas versus the GA areas.
And different cells might have different levels of these tools.
Right. Imagine a cell type that needs to silence a bunch of genes that just happen to sit in these GA-rich regions. That cell might pump out tons of EPOP.
But another cell type, one dealing with GCN-rich regions, might rely heavily on MTF2 instead.
It gives the organism this incredible flexibility. It can fine-tune which genes are turned off across different developmental lineages without having to change the core engine, PRC2. You just swap out the accessory cartridge.
That is such a cool way to think about it. It's like a modular power tool. You just change the bit depending on the wood you're drilling into.
And it changes how we look at junk DNA. Those repeats, the GCN, the GA in the linker regions, they aren't coding for proteins, but they are not junk. They're part of the instruction manual for the silencing machinery.
That is a massive shift in perspective. It means the empty space is actually helping determine the fate of the cell.
It really is. And it shows that nature doesn't waste space. What might look like background noise, these simple repetitive sequences, are actually fine-tuning knobs for gene expression.
So if you had to summarize this for someone at a dinner party, you asks, so what did you learn today? How do you boil this down?
I would say that we discovered that the machine responsible for turning off our genes, PRC2, isn't a one-size-fits-all engine. It uses specialized partners, EPOP and MTF2, to read specific patterns in our DNA. MTF2 reads GCN patterns, and EPOP reads GA patterns. They are specialized keys for very specialized locks.
And it solves a years-long mystery about EPOP. It's not a break. It's a context-dependent accelerator.
That's the headline.
I want to leave our listeners with a thought that really popped into my head while reading this. If this machinery is relying so heavily on these specific patterns in the non-coding DNA, you know, the stuff between the nucleosomes.
I see where you're going with this.
What does this mean for genetic diseases? We usually look for mutations in the genes themselves in coding parts. But what if you have a mutation in the GA repeat zip code?
That is a profound question. It implies there could be a whole class of silencing disorders where the gene is fine, the protein it codes for is fine, but the do not enter sign just falls off because the road texture changed.
And the machine just drives right past.
It drives right past. And suddenly a gene that should be off is now on. That just opens up a massive door for future research.
It really does. It's never just about the gene. It's about the context.
Oh, geez.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.
Under glass and quiet light, I feel the chromatin breathe. Threads between the spools of night, a hidden alphabet in me. Not the landing, it's the writing. When the silence starts to bloom, a mark that draws a boundary line inside. Read the link of code. Code, PA, let it go.